Hi there, you're listening to High Performance, the show that unlocks the minds of some of the most fascinating people on the planet. I'm Jake Humphrey, and alongside Damien Hughes, our expert in high-performing team cultures, we learn from the stories, successes, and struggles of our guests, allowing us all to explore, be challenged, and to grow. Here's what's coming up today.
We had fights every week. There was somebody fighting each other in the training because there was a crazy tackle or there was something like that. But the level of training, the intensity of the training session, it was insane. You know, imagine you are on the bed in the hospital and the doctor keeps coming and asks you your name, people around, the day, the month, the year, which country you are. And it's something you know is the easiest question all your life you knew the answer. And suddenly he asks you and you go, like the simplest question. And you couldn't answer. I couldn't answer. I play a year and a half with broken shoulders, both actually. Before I had the surgery, I had it for 14 months, like broken labrum, couldn't lift my arms. Nobody knew. I was training, I was playing, I was doing everything. And every single time I dive and made a save, I had tears coming like that. It was a terrible pain. But I knew I can perform.
So welcome to the show, the brilliant Petr Cech, a goalkeeper who played 443 Premier League games, won four Premier League titles, the first and the last were a decade apart. I mean, that in itself is incredible. Five times he lifted the FA Cup, he won the Champions League, he won the Europa League, and for 3 years, he was in the boardroom as Chelsea's technical and performance advisor before walking away in 2022. So that's what Petr's done. How he's done it will blow your mind. Stories you didn't know, vulnerability you aren't expecting, insight that you get so rarely. Honestly, I can't thank Petr enough for choosing High Performance to share his story. And don't forget, if you want more, download the High Performance app right now for free from the App Store. And on there, you can actually hear Petr talking about how he was brought back into competitive football early after his life-threatening head injury. And also, and this is interesting, why there was nothing enjoyable about playing in a Champions League final. Wow. If you want to know what that's all about, download the High Performance app for more right now. But let's do it then. Time to welcome the legendary Petr Cech to High Performance. Just before we welcome today's guest, we've got some messages from our valued partners. If you prefer to listen ad-free, you can do so on the High Performance app. Hey everyone, look, myself and Damien want just 1 minute of your time to talk to you about Whoop, game-changing wearable tech. And we've partnered with Whoop to offer you a 30-day risk-free trial. All you need to do is hit the link in the description to this podcast and you can make 2024 your best year yet.
Whoop measures your fitness, your recovery and your sleep. And best of all, it coaches you through. And we know the importance of getting feedback and consistent behaviours. Whoop helps you get both.
And I think that sleep is the underrated golden bullet for high performance. I can't talk highly enough of Whoop. And if you're interested in signing up, all you need to do is hit the link in the description to this podcast. And once you've done that, you can go to the Whoop app, hit the community tab, join the high performance community, and you might just win the chance to come and join us for a recording of the high performance podcast.
So sign up now at join.whoop.com/HPP.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Petta, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
What is high performance to you?
High performance, like if you look at the, I don't know, in a sort of like a simple definition of performance, you would have the execution of an action. Yeah. So if you talk about high performance, it has to be a high level execution of an action, whatever you do. So for me, it's that, you know, how well you can do what you do, you know. And you know, if you talk about elite group of people, if you talk about the best league in the world or any sport or any profession, that you expect people to consistently, you know, do that action in a very high effective level. So that's for me the high level performance.
I'm so pleased that you've started in that way, because I think if there's one thing that, you know, defines your career, it is consistency, the ability to be at the top for so long. It's an easy thing to say, it's a hard thing to do. I'd be fascinated to know how you think you were so good for so long.
You know, there are many ways how you can go along and achieve things, but I think consistency is one thing. If you don't have, you don't achieve. Or you would have to be really lucky. Or you would have to be so good, so talented, or you would have to get some, in a way, some help from somewhere, that it's everything falls for you. Yeah. And this is because if you're not consistent, you're not consistently getting better, you're not consistently working, then you don't have the consistency in your performances. Therefore, you risk that you're not going to be picked, you're not going to play, and so on and so on and so on. So it's very easy to start something. You know, you always get ideas and you start. But if you're not consistent, you probably never finish, you know. So that's the thing, or it takes you much longer, or the result is not
so
the same.
Why did we struggle with consistency so much, and how did you manage to find it?
I think it's the consistency is a self-discipline. It's literally your discipline. And I think, you know, you always hear, you know, the people with discipline, they are the ones who actually, you know, manage to go the furthest, because they are always prepared, they are always, you know, trying to do. And, you know, I always see when people say, you know, we can have a better commitment, you know, we can put 110%, or we can do that. And I always, like, in my mind, I always laugh, because, for example, I think in commitment, you can't really measure it. You either committed or you're not. For me, it's like two ways. If you committed, you do it full speed ahead. If you're not, you do it 60, 50%. And then therefore you're not really committed, because then, you know, you can't be half committed. It's like, it's almost impossible. So, and if you're committed, you have discipline. It goes together, you know? Yeah. And I think that's the two parts which are very important, the commitment and the discipline. It just drives you forward. And therefore, you can have the consistency, because to be consistent, you have to do things at the day you fancy it, the same way at the day when you wake up and I'm going, I'm not doing this today. I don't feel right and I don't want. And you know that in order to get better, you have to go and do it. So you just go and do it. And that's the powerful engine which just keeps going, you know, in you. And you don't need people to be standing and saying, come on, do that. Come on, you know, run one more time. Oh, come on, do this one more time. No, you should be the opposite. Should be doing it, and people almost telling you, oh, okay, enough. Don't worry, you know, don't worry.
So can you give us some examples of the consistent traits that you adopted throughout your career that you feel help you maintain that longevity?
You know, every day I come to work, I come to do better. Yeah. And to learn, to make sure that whatever I do with 100% commitment and 100% attitude, that you go and you think, okay, I do that, it will allow me to get better. Because, you know, you will have days where your body is tired, So basically, if that in that moment, if you're 100%, it's here, yeah, it can be here. Maybe another day, your 100% will be here because your body will be tired. You know, you have a lot of games sometimes, you travel, not enough sleep, you might have a bit of flu or something like that. But even in that moment, if you do 100% of what you are able to do at every day, it will make you better. It will still get you better prepared. It will always do that. And you know, every game, like if anybody asks me, like I play exactly the same game, and all my career I played exactly the same game, if it was a preseason friendly or a Champions League final. If you put the camera on me and if you put the microphone on me, you would not find one single difference.
Why?
Because the consistent action every single second makes your performance consistent. Basically, the role of me as a goalkeeper on the pitch never changes with amount of people in the stand. It never changes. You know, the importance of the game. Yeah, it is important game or less important game, but the role of the goalkeeper is still the same. My job is exactly the same. So I just got every single second in every single game with my job. And I was ignoring the score, I was ignoring the referee, I was ignoring everything around in my head. And I think that was the biggest strength to keep consistency as well, is that in my head, the score was always 0-0. There is no score. Because, you know, my job was the same at 3-0 up or 3-0 down. I still need to do the simple pass as well as the catch the simple ball.
Mess up on the pitch?
You mess up. That's the part of the process. You mess up and just carry on. So you just get on with the next action and you just carry on with the next action. And because this is the only way to help everybody is just if you keep going. You know, you can start thinking about... The thing is, if you start thinking about what you've done, that it takes you away from thinking about what you have to do. And then, of course, the biggest risk is that you do something silly again, because your concentration will not be on what you are supposed to do or about what you have done. And that's already in the past and it doesn't help you. So if you keep that in mind and you just go, so I just went along with it. And then after the game, you just go, okay, what a disaster. If it was a disaster, you feel it, you know it. But then the strength of just get the next action right. Next action is the next action. And you just get on with it. And you have no other chance.
So how did you learn to be able to stay in the moment then and process triumph or disaster to be able to just follow the process?
You know, when I was about 12, 13, I was very... stressed about playing a football game in goal because I had the feeling to concede. You know, you always feel like an ultimate failure all the time, you know, you concede. So that first goal, you just go, I don't want to concede. I want to clean sheet. This is what it's all about. You're not supposed to concede a goal. You're not supposed to fail. So it put a lot of stress on me. And then I realized that I was very stressed. And then if somebody scored, that all this part of, okay, now we conceded, so I will not have a clean sheet, so I can just get on with it. I was 13. And then it started bothering me because I'm thinking, you know, then I play much more relaxed and better game the moment I concede. So I almost felt like if I put in my mind that we are 1-0 down, maybe it will sort of switch a little bit and I will go a little bit, you know, not to be so focused on not conceding rather than what I'm supposed to do. And then when I was 14, I figured out that if I just ignored the score and ignored all the stuff I couldn't control, so the referee, the decisions, if my teammate missed a penalty or big chance, in the end of the day, I realized that it had nothing to do with my job. So from that moment, when I was 14, I literally put in my mind, okay, my job, there is no score, there is no problem, there is no referee, there are no people, there is nobody watching. There is like, okay, you do your job. And from there, actually, my career really, I found myself in it. Because it actually helped me to be consistent. I had the same approach in like a match system, which started 2 hours prior to the game, and I went through with no disruptions. And then you really find the advantage of not being stressed about a lot of things. And I do it with anything I do. I still do it because I have a concept of steps. in my mind. And I think that's something which is really important, that if you want to execute something in a really efficient and best way, there are steps how to do it. You know, your computer never changes the pattern of the whatever algorithm it gets, because it knows that if they do it exactly like that, they will have the best result. Yeah. So that is, it's the same. Whatever you do, it has certain steps you have to.
What are your
steps? You have to do. So, for example, if you take a simple catch, yeah. So first thing, you need to be in the right position. You need to be set. You need to have hands in the right position. Track the ball with your eyes. Put the hands in the right position. Thumb behind. So you have steps in order to have a simple catch. If you skip one of those steps, you put yourself at risk that you will not be on time, and then you might fumble it. You might, you know, it might go wrong.
You made a reference earlier, Petter, to so after a mistake or a disappointing result, when you let the emotion out in the dressing room. And I'm interested about how you go through the process then of, so after you've gone through the process of performing, how do you do the review stage after a disappointing result or performance?
Oh, I watch all the actions. Then you suddenly realize that there were good actions as well, not only the bad ones, because it's rarely is only the bad one. So you can actually find a lot of things there where you go, actually, you know what? There are many things I've done right. Obviously, there might be if you make an obvious mistake, one or two, and then you see it, you just go, you know. But that applies in the same way in a game where you play really well, you know, because sometimes the score is not the reflection of your performance. And, you know, I'm always puzzled, you know, when you see sometimes people talking about performance of a football team, for example, yeah, and then you have a goalkeeper is a man of the match, makes 10 saves. Yeah. So you have these ratings sometimes if people rate how well people played. And because the team won 1-0 and because the goalkeeper make 8 saves, all defenders have a really high rating. And I'm thinking, how can a defense have a high rating or team have a high defensive rating when they allowed 8 chances? Yeah. You know, if you lose 1-0 somewhere in a game which is not particularly looking good and people think you should win it, but then you don't allow any chances as a team, you play really well, people might have a little, like a small rating because the outcome was not right. So, you know, the performance is not measured by your person in performance is not measured by if your team won or not.
The outcome.
If you play really well, you play really well, and you should know that you play really well. If your team wins 5-0 and you are the worst player on the pitch, then you have to look at it and you go, yeah, today I was bad. So, you know, we won, I'm happy. But my contribution was not good.
I think the power of communication is really vital, right, when you're a goalkeeper. Can you explain to us how much of a challenge that is when you might have 4 nationalities standing in front of you?
Well, I went to an extreme little bit, yeah, in that case. So I obviously speak few other languages than English and Czech. So I speak French, Spanish, English, German, Czech, obviously. And so when I was giving instruction to a player I knew is new player, and I knew that it will be faster to give in his native language, I did it. So I would have sometimes in the games, I would use 3 different languages to speak to people on the pitch just to make sure that they understand what I want. And I realized that by accident, actually, it was not something I really thought I would do all the time. But when we, you know, when you bring new players and you have somebody who can't speak English, yeah, so you have players who come, just join the club, they can't speak English, so they only speak Spanish. And then you just go, well, I'm really precise of what I want them to do. Sometimes a one step makes a huge difference for me, because if they cover that step or if they do what I ask them to do, it allows me to play the whole situation completely differently than if I don't tell them. So I knew that if I tell them in English, they will not get it. So in a way, I was like, you know what? I learned the specific words in different languages just to make sure that if I need it, and I knew that player will instantly get it. So I did it.
And then
it became the habit. But when you call an instruction which includes everybody, then of course you say it in English. Everybody sticks to that.
Right.
But if it was a specific instruction only to one player, and I could tell it, I could tell him in his own language, then I did it.
So what was the accident that made you realize that was the most effective way?
I think it was in when I was at Chelsea, we signed Asier Del Horno from Bilbao, and he couldn't say a word English. So I went to Jose, and I said to him, "Listen, can you put me all these words? Can you put me all these words like that I can use for him in that particular moment in the games, because I think it's gonna help him." And that's actually how I start. This is how I learned Spanish, actually. Because once I started learning that, then I started learning more words, and then I started, and I literally learned all Spanish after that. So, because it was more fun, you know, then you suddenly can speak to them not only about five words in on the pitch or 10 or 20, then you can speak to him outside of the pitch as well, and you understand what kind of person it is, and it helps everybody. So this is how I did it, yeah.
You mentioned Jose Mourinho there. You signed for Chelsea just before he arrived, right? And I remember him arriving and all of us seeing this super confident guy in the press conference calling himself the special one. From the outside, like, it seemed like a real landmark moment in English football. I'm really interested to know what it was like from your perspective.
Well, I signed in January, and then I stayed in France till the end of the season, played the Euros in Portugal for Czech Republic, and then I came over to England. So it was actually good for me knowing that I have 5 months before I joined, because then I could work on my English. And then that was obviously a big, you know, when you're in goal, the communication is important for me. But then Claudio Ranieri was the coach at the time. And then suddenly I saw this change and I'm thinking, oh, so this is the manager who signed me, kind of, and he's not even going to be there. So I was thinking, okay, what is it going to be like? But at the same time, you go to a new club full of internationals, huge ambition, hugely ambitious coach, and everybody starts on the same line. And I think that was actually the biggest advantage for me, because, you know, I came to the club where Carlo Cudicini was absolutely outstanding. So you just think, you know, new manager will not really look at what players did before. He will look at them like, you know, you put everybody in on the line and you go, okay, show me what you can do. And that probably was my advantage, because then I could, you know, I had the same start as everybody else. And to be honest, I think the way Jose was at the beginning with the mentality to, you know, to the training, the approach to the games, like it was all about winning. You know, like you rather lose than draw. So even in his tactics, when you play a home game, he said at the beginning, he said, I rather lose than draw. I hate draws. It takes you nowhere. So
what did that do for you?
So you go like, you know, if we are drawing at home, I'm going to just put three at the back, put extra striker, and we play to win. I don't care if I lose. And then in the end, I think he didn't lose for 6-7 years, whatever it was.
But does a goalkeeper like that approach? Surely you're thinking, don't do that to me.
To be honest, I prefer to go to, you know, if you go to the pitch, you should not go thinking, okay, let's start and see what happens. No, because you're not in control of that. If you go there and you go, okay, we do everything to win, we take charge of it, we do it. And I think we learn how to take charge of the games. And we understood as well, like I think in a way he said, okay, we do that. But if you have games where you know you're second best, where you know you're not going to win because the opponent is too good, or in that particular game you are not good, then make sure that you get something out of it, the most of it. So then we knew how to win games where we were not particularly good, but we knew we're aware of it. So we were like, okay, let's just keep going the way that we get most of it. And most of the time you actually found the winner somewhere, because the approach, the mentality was there. And I think he was him and his coaching staff, they brought that mentality in, and, you know, that confidence about that, that sort of little arrogance about that, but the confidence of, I have a team which can do it, I pushed them into doing it, and he did it really well, and that's why I think we had very successful two seasons back to back titles, and that's why he was successful generally everywhere he went.
So I'm interested because during that time as well, you set a record for keeping an incredible number of clean sheets and being regarded as defensively the strongest team in the league. And you spoke about this mentality of having this score is 0-0. Whenever we concede a goal, we just go back to the process. How much work did you do with your defenders to adopt that same mindset so that you didn't have tantrums or people pointing the finger or blame?
I think I had a huge advantage. Obviously, I played with JT there, and they had you had Galas, Carvalho, and you can and so on and so on. You can go with all the players I had, and there was a common goal. We actually, I think we took pride in not conceding goals as a team, because you realize that if you don't concede, you just need to score one in order to win. It's a massive help. The moment you go ahead, you feel like, hey, game done. Because we are good, we work hard, we are good. But at the same time, these people around were as demanding as I was. So it was completely normal to have an argument about a situation where, you go along and you call people and you tell them what they want them to do, and they respect it because you see things better than them. But if they had something to say, well, I can't do that because this guy is too fast or too good to do that, whatever, then I had to respect what they see as well. So we would always sort of exchange the ideas and we would do it. And then more you play together, obviously you get automatic, you realize each player plays a certain way, and then you just go, yeah, so it can work. In luck with Carvalho is at the beginning, I have to say, it was completely special because he looked like he's not even interested in anything. Like he was there and there, and you think like, oh my God, is he switched on? Is he not switched on? But then you have a pass, which I remember we played United and Rooney made like a really interesting action and completely this guy's pass, which I was thinking like, oh God, how did he pull that one? And Carvalho was standing there and just controlled the ball. And I'm thinking like, how did he know? Like, how did he read that? And he had the unbelievable reading of the game. So he had JT, who was the one who was marshalling the defense, very strong one-on-one physical presence, communication, the mentality. And then he had this guy who read like every play like a book and played off him. And you just go, that's this is a very strong partnership. And Galas did the same, then Gary Cahill, then, David Luiz, you bring players in and you realize how they could play it well together. Ivanovic, obviously, I don't want to forget anyone because, but it's always an important aspect is how well people connect in between each other and if they can communicate well and know how to use each other's strength. And we had a team structure, which everybody was clear about. We had the right mentality, and then we had the individual players who had the big quality. And we had fights every week. There was somebody fighting each other in the training because there was a crazy tackle or there was something like that. But the level of training, the intensity of the training session, it was insane. I remember when Carlo Ancelotti came. So first training session, and he goes, oh, everybody is excited. Everybody wants to show. And I said to him, today was not a good session. Actually, the intensity was not as good. And he was surprised because he said, well, the intensity was insane. And that was the key to success as well, because the trainings were like games. People were competing for spaces, competing to get into the game. And that was actually really important to
how was that
be
culture
like that.
Created? Because there'll be people listening to this that work in business and they would love a culture where people really care to that level. How was that fostered?
It's the repetition. If you have somebody demanding that level of intensity, concentration, the execution in every day, more often you do it, people get habit of doing it. Because you have to set the standard. Yeah, so this is where the importance is. There's a lot of times what happens is you have a new boss or new people coming in and they come and say, this is my standard, this is what I want. And then 2 weeks later, you suddenly see that, you know, step by step, the things they said the first day, it's too much effort to keep them, so they don't do it anymore. And you just go, okay, so then you drop the standard, you know, or you know that that is not the real standard that, you know, you might say about it, but the actions actually speak for itself. But when you keep that going and you go and relentlessly you keep that standard and you know this is a standard, nobody goes below. And if somebody drops below, you let them know.
So you either push them, tell us about that bit.
You either push them up or you put them out. If somebody really dropped the standard, the manager would come and say, listen, you were so bad this week and in that game, you don't deserve. So this guy comes in. Then you suddenly realize where the level is. And you have no complaints. You can complain if you do all that and you don't get in. But if your colleague actually playing in your place is getting man of the match after man of the match, playing so well, then you just have to go, no, fair play to him. He just keeps his spot.
But can you give us an example? Because you use that phrase there that if somebody isn't reaching the standards, you either try and lift them up or eventually you just push them out. Tell us about how you would give somebody feedback apart from setting the example yourself.
You know, sometimes you need to speak to players. You need to tell them the things which are not really nice. You know, the reality sometimes is, you know, the reality is sometimes hard. You just go and say, okay, you know, you have to figure out why the person is struggling, why he's not doing what he's not doing. And then if you see them working every day, and you go like, yeah, but I watch you for 2 weeks straight and everybody is doing, has bigger effort, bigger concentration, push harder than you in training. And now you're surprised you're not picked. You know, this is not how you do it. Or you can't be surprised that your performance is not as good if you don't do the right things.
Yeah.
Or if there is a reason for it, obviously you would like to know. But then this is about communication. I think sometimes the problem in the past, I would say, you know, we talk a lot about mental health. Yeah. So every time, everything is mental health now. Sometimes it's just the lack of resilience. But because sometimes when you hear the reality, it can be hard. But the reason why now, like we speak a lot about mental health, it's the what we carried from before. You know, we sort of inherited that culture where, you know, when I grew up, you were like, men don't cry. You're not supposed to be weak. You're not supposed to feel pain. And the winners go like, whoa, they never have any issues, you know? So basically you had people who struggled with a lot of things and they had anxiety, maybe felt a bit, you know, whatever it was, might have a difficult time in their private life. They would never share. The reason was because everybody was like, oh, this player is weak, you don't put them. You have to have all these strong guys only on the pitch to win the game. So they would not have the confidence to say to the coach, I have a private life problem. I know I'm struggling at the moment. I'm trying, but you know, I need a help a little bit with something. And they would say, you know, I push you here and there, I give you a week off, and then you go back in. But they would not do it because everybody was afraid that if you say it, oh, I have pain, I have this, and I have feel, then they would not put you in.
Did things happen in those days that would never be accepted now?
Yeah, a lot of times. You know, the way the coach speak to you, the way they, you know, sometimes like laid things on you with no hesitation, like let you run for 3 hours around the pitch if they didn't like the way you train. Until you flop literally, or like nowadays you would not do it. You know, it's a bit of a respect, but as well, it's I think the generation is completely different to what it was. We were used to that. I don't say it's good. I don't think, you know, you don't want to go from one extreme to another, but at the same time, I think, you know, you build resilience as well by putting people under pressure. You know, making sure that they understand that. If they don't do enough, it's not enough. You don't want to destroy people just because they have a difficult moment. But at the same time, you need to show them that in a difficult time, it's not the time to feel sorry for yourself. It's time to find the solution, how to get better and how to go through it.
Well, that plays very nicely into the next topic I'd like to talk about, which was a period in your career where you needed resilience because you were almost killed on the football pitch. What are your memories of the day when that happened?
Well, I think to my advantage that I have a couple of days from my memory erased, yeah, so I don't really remember much. I always said, you know, I remember the dressing room, I remember the stadium, yeah, the way we came to the stadium, dressing room, warm up, and then a handshake. That's the last bit, because we had a handshake, and then we lost the toss, so we had to swap sides. So I remember going, you know, from one goal to another. Then we came first time, we came back to Reading, and actually I walked to the stadium and I'm like, I don't remember this. I don't remember that. I thought that there was like a different way to go to the dressing room, and dressing room on the other side. It was completely.
So what was the last thing that you?
So I don't know. You know, I got it probably confused with some other stadium. You know, so but really the last thing I remember is swapping the sides after the toss. That's the last bit. But the parts before I don't really recall. And after like 2-3 days I don't recall. To be honest, I was in the induced comas for some time. So basically, you know, maybe there's a bit of a loss there. I don't know. You know,
so
I'm not an expert.
There's a coin toss. They're swapping sides. What's and the next memory?
Being in hospital.
How many days later?
I don't know. Probably. Well, the honest thing is that I kept losing memory. Eh? So basically, I woke up. Everybody explained to me what happened. In 15 minutes, I couldn't keep up anymore. So I fell asleep again, woke up, couldn't remember anything. And that's the part I remember, you know, this is the first time just before my memory came back. Yeah. I remember being like, it's even an absurd, if it's something you've never lived there and you never experienced, you would never really feel that. But imagine you were on the bed in the hospital. And the doctor keeps coming and ask you your name, people around, the day, the month, the year, which country you are. And it's something you know is the easiest question all your life you knew the answer. And suddenly he asks you and you go, like the simplest question. And you couldn't answer. I couldn't answer. I didn't know. I just couldn't recall anything. And then that was really the moment where you just go, whoa, you know. And then the memory came back and I was thinking like, oh, thanks God, like I've got, like I feel normal now, you know, with the memory.
But you're sort of smiling when you tell that story, but I can only imagine this level of fear you would have had at that moment.
You can't really describe. It's a complete confusion, because when you hear the question, you know the answer, you just can't tell anything, you just suddenly can't recall anything, right. And suddenly it feels like that part is jammed. You don't know what to say. And it's like the easiest question is, what's your name and do you know where you are? What country, what year, what date? And you just go, I should know. But suddenly you don't. And then, when all the memory came back, it was actually a kind of a sense of relief, thinking, you know, that the most of the, you know, I remember my wife, because then she was there every day with me sitting next to the bed. So that was the easy, you know, because you see her every time I woke up, she was there. So then you just, you know, you get that memory back. But then I think the biggest chunk of the memory came back when all the team came to visit. You know, when people walk in the room and you suddenly go like, oh, I know this guy. Oh, that's Drogba. Oh, that's Sheva or JT and all the other people. And you just go, oh, now I remember this guy. So that was the biggest part, when you suddenly start getting things back, and then every day it got better and better. And the incident, I don't recall. And I think that was the biggest advantage for me coming back to the pitch.
Yep.
Because, you know, you have people who have a car crash and everything, and they remember the moment where it happened. So there was some angle, the car was in some angle, the other car hit them, yeah? And so every single time you drive and that angle kind of occurs, they will be like, ooh, that's the moment, yeah. You know? I never had that, because you don't really remember diving and getting, you know, kicked. So I was like, I could see it on the video, obviously. But in a way, when I came back on the pitch, it never crossed my mind.
This episode of High Performance is brought to you in association with AG1. Look, we know that taking care of your health isn't always easy, but we should make it as simple as possible. If there's one thing that guests have told us here on High Performance over the years, it's that getting closer to high performance has to be an easy thing to do. Therefore, it encourages you to do it. I believe drinking AG1 every single day with no exceptions gets me closer to my own version of high performance. And it's so simple. A scoop, mixed in water, at the start of every day. And I promise you, everything's better. My energy, my focus, I just feel stronger. I know that AG1 is delivering my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, and so much more. But it also means I start the day with a powerful, healthy habit. And I think starting the day in the right way actually leads to a day where I keep on making really good decisions. I also love that I realize what I'm doing is really helping me. All the ingredients are sourced for absorption, potency, and nutrient density. Every single batch goes through a rigorous testing process, and AG1 covers my bases with high-quality ingredients, vitamins, minerals, adaptogens, antioxidants, and whole food-sourced nutrients. I just know if I drink it daily, I get a boost, and I feel great. So if there's one product that I would recommend to elevate your health, it is AG1, and that is why I've partnered with them for so long. And if you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. And thanks to listening to this podcast, you will also get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase. Just go to drinkag1.com/HPP. That's drinkag1.com/HPP. Check it out.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Today's show is brought to you in association with MindLift, the most personalized brain training app that can help improve your focus and your relaxation. So MindLift is neuroscience-based, and what I love about MindLift, I've been using it for a while now, is that it's totally personalized to me. So if you're interested in optimizing your health, I would recommend you check out MindLift. And don't just take my word for it. Take the word of the elite athletes and the industry leaders who use it. So MindLift accesses brain sensing technology, games and videos that correspond to your brain's activity. Honestly, it's fascinating. You wear a smart headband which measures your brain activity and gets you a personalized routine to sharpen your mental fitness. I've been using it first thing in the morning, and genuinely, when I go into early meetings or I've got lots happening in a day, I notice the difference. I'd love you to start your personalized program at mindlift.com/high performance, and you will get $40 off your first subscription. That's mindlift.com/high performance.
Famously, Jose Mourinho at the time was very angry about the challenge from Stephen Hunt, I think it was, and he then directed his anger at the ambulance services that had came to you. Was that not an emotion that you identified with?
You know, I tried to look at this different way. I think there were moments where I felt like, why it happened to me? And then in the same time, I just go, okay, what does it change? I need, like, the good thing what changed, and you always need something bad to make a good change sometimes, and it happens in a human history of the history of humankind all the time. You need sometimes something bad to happen that people come together and find solution to make a better protection. So, for example, you know, the requirement for the Premier League was not to have the ambulance at the stadium. So that's why there was this delay. And that caused the biggest issue. So since then, obviously, you have the requirement. Every Premier League stadium has the paramedics at the stadium. You've seen in the past 10 years how many people got saved at the stadium, not only players, but even the fans in the stands, thanks to the fact that the paramedics are there. So that changed the rule and actually make everybody safer. So in a way, it's a good thing. Yeah, so let's, you know, it's always something bad has to happen for that, you know, for something good to happen too. I just felt like, okay, I just want to move forward. So what kind of I didn't like was when everybody just kept asking about it. You know, you just go, well, I've said enough, just let me move on. You know, you have a saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. So in that case, actually, it worked pretty well. And you need to look at this sometimes this way. And I have to say that in those situations, you have two options. Yeah, so you either look at everything as a problem or you look at everything as a challenge. So every time I face the difficulties, I don't see it as a problem. I always see it as a challenge. So basically, you know, the doctors told me, I said, listen, forget the season. You don't play. We'll see how everything goes. If you can come back, you come back. If you can't come back, you know, you do something else. But let's, you know, let's forget the season. We concentrate day by day. And then maybe, you know, if you're fit, ready to go, you jump into preseason. And then you go like from a restart the season after. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to do everything I can every single day to go and give myself a chance to come back. And then we will see where it takes me. And I said to him, if it takes me 10 months, if it takes me 5 months, if it takes me 2 years, whatever it is, let's do it and see where we go. And that was the best part, because I just went day by day. And second, and I think very important part, was that with the medical team, we sat down, and obviously there was challenge. You know, when you have a knee surgery, you know pretty much how it goes. With the brain, obviously, it was completely different, because I had days where I couldn't do nothing. I couldn't do anything. Like, I woke up in the morning and I couldn't get out of bed. Like, every slightest of noise, every movement, every activity just killed me. I just couldn't. Like, I was literally lying and I couldn't do it. But then there were days where I could do like almost what we planned for the day plus next 2 days. We put the plan day by day with my head injury. And they said, okay, you make the choice. If you feel you have enough, you have enough. If you can't, you can't. If you can, you can. And this was exactly what was happening. I told them, we carry on, we carried on. When I said, like, sometimes we started and I said, guys, I have to stop. And they said, okay, fine, you stop. But then they knew, because they knew I pushed myself to the limit. So they knew that when the moment I said I can't, they knew I can't. Mm. Like, I always have that. And what was a great learning process in that moment for me was that I was getting signs from the brain where it had enough. So I had always the, like, 5 minutes prior to complete like a switch off, I would have my eyes sticking like that. So here you could feel that was going like that. The eyelids were going. So the moment my eyelids started going, I knew that I have 5 minutes to stop and rest, drink, eat, or anything. Otherwise, it would.
What would happen 5 minutes after?
I would just pass out, fall asleep.
Really?
And so this is where the control was very important.
Yeah.
And this is where I learned actually how to listen to my body, because once I ignore that and I pass out, it's not a good feeling. So then I was like, okay, if next time that happens, I don't ignore it. And then it obviously, you know, went better and better. So I could do more time, more days, more guys in a row. And as well, in that moment, I started making notes about the days. Yeah, because sometimes you have a you know, your emotions take over and you have a bad day, and you just go, it's going nowhere, I have bad days, and I'm never going to recover like that. But if you make notes of the good days, bad days, and you look at the bigger picture, then you just go, oh, hold on a minute. Last month, I had 6 bad days, 1 good day. Then it went to 5 bad days and 2 good days. And now I'm actually 3 bad days, 4 good days. So you suddenly go, you know what? No matter how it feels, how bad it feels, or it feels slow, I'm actually doing really well. And I think in the end of the day, I think the closest are the ones who suffer the most. It was not really me. You know, I had in my mind that I do everything every day to, you know, to get there, and there is a bit little light at the end of the tunnel. Okay, I go there closer and closer. And that was my, you know, in my mind. But they were the ones who saw me flat out and tired and not the same. So I think they were the one who suffered the most in the end.
When was the injury? What month? October, November?
It was October 14, 2006.
And they said, your season's over. How many months later did you return?
I played, I think it was about like 107 days after the surgery. So you needed, I think by... So the 12 weeks, the first 12 weeks is where you need the skull to consolidate. So the bone. To get back together to heal. So basically the doctor said, whatever you do, you can't do anything for 12 weeks because it's literally impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they will not be fit, strong, even to think about doing anything 100%. So the first months I was learning the little things and I was going over all these issues with my brain. Second month I started training, like physical training, on my own. The third month, I would play tennis. So I had a helmet all the time. All the time I had the helmet on. And that was the only circumstances. He said, well, we can't let you, like, you can't even slightly touch anything. So you need to have it. So you have to do it on your own. So I was playing tennis most of the time, training, working in a gym, running, doing things on my own, like throwing balls off the wall, small balls, but not high. If I missed it, it never hit my head. So things like that. And gradually I felt so strong. I was working was my go-to thing in the end. So I felt so strong. So when after 12 weeks, the doctor said, actually now you might think about going into trainings where people can shoot the ball at you, because now you have to keep the helmet, but the bone is fine. So it will never be as strong, but you know, you have the helmet, so it should be fine. So then I said, okay, let's go. So I went to the training, but I was so physically fit that I felt like, you know what, I can do that. So I went to training, did about 2 training sessions with the team, and then we went to Liverpool. And then Jose asked me, he said, okay, do you want to play? And I said to him, you know what, if I travel, you know, let's go. I go. And then I played. But so there was the decision which I made. Obviously, you know, they were saying, you know, take your time, it might be more difficult, whatever. But I just felt that I was ready. I felt that for me, the best thing to do. When we went to Liverpool, I went home. I said to my wife, well, they want me to travel to the game. And she said, oh God, I heard that before. She goes like, are you joking? So I said to her, I said, no, we haven't decided yet whether I play or not. And she said, I know you're going to play.
When did you make the final decision to play?
Well, the moment I decided to travel, I knew I was going to play.
The feeling when you made that first save or touched the first ball or contributed?
No, you know, I made a good save there. I made somewhere at the beginning was I made quite a good save, and I felt like, you know what, I'm fine. The only thing which I underestimated and which I never really thought was the helmet. Because you have covered, you know, partially your ears and the back of the head.
Yep.
So although I was never really aware of that much, because you don't really think, but you have receptors on your skin, on your hair. So when somebody's standing behind you, you actually feel them, no matter how, like, you don't really think about that, but you actually, it helps, you know, you sort of have that feeling like something's there. But when you have the helmet, you hear a different way and you, even that, you know, you don't have the same feeling. So, you know, you always have to kind of like scan more a little bit. So I had to learn that. But then you play one, two games and I got used to it. And then I never really, you know, then you just go along with it and it was fine.
So you went through a period of many managerial changes, quite a lot of upheaval at Chelsea, probably a lot of uncertainty for the players. Also, there was a period where you were constantly getting close to winning the Champions League and fell short again and again, including, you know, the famous penalty shootout. What should we talk about first? The ability to deal with all the change or the Champions League?
When I started playing, I was 17. I signed my professional contract. I played for Chmel Bleszany, which was the small team in the Czech league. Sadly, doesn't exist anymore because it's literally a village, so they couldn't sustain it when there were changes of the ownership and that. So then obviously, so I started there. And then I signed for Sparta Prague when I was 18 or 19. And everybody was saying, why is Sparta Prague buying this guy? He has no chance to play. But we had a new coach, and then the first three games didn't really happen well. So the fourth game of the season, the goalkeeper coach came to me and he said to me, you know, I think the manager is going to put you in, play an away game, so be prepared for it. So we played an away game in Opava. I went there and we won 2-1. I played really well. And then I stayed in goal. We went 900 plus minutes without conceding, broke all the records of invincibility, number of clean sheets in one season and all that. Played 12 games in the Champions League. Actually beat Mourinho in his first game as a Porto manager. He played the first game in the Champions League at Sparta Prague with me in goal. We won 2-0. But so it kind of went this way. Then I went to European Championship under 21. We won it in penalties in the final. I went to France, and then from France I came to Chelsea. But what I learned there is that it doesn't matter how many people are there in, you know, you're competing with. Ultimately, you compete with yourself. If you can be the best version of you, if you can train as hard as you can, if you can show everybody around that you are the person to pick, they might have a different strategy at the beginning, but they can't keep ignoring it in a way. Yeah, no matter what it is, like everybody has the common goal. You want to win, you want to have the best people around you, and you want to use the ones who perform the best that your common goal get achieved, no matter if it's a company, if it's a football team, school group, whoever, you know, you think. So I learned there that it's not ultimately about who you're competing with. It's about showing everybody that you deserve the goal, that you are prepared, you are there, you're ready. And as well, when you're ready, if your chance come, the possibility that you take your chance with both hands and you don't let it slip is when you're prepared. Because a lot of times happens in the life where people go, oh, the manager doesn't count with me, didn't put me in. And then you don't train properly, you don't do things, and suddenly he puts you in, you're not prepared. And you have a worst game ever, and they go, okay, this guy's out because, you know, I give him a chance and nothing happened. So you let your life slip through your fingers because you're not prepared. So I was always prepared. And every day I prepared. I trained as I was playing.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, okay, if he puts me in, I'm going to show him I'm the guy who can do it. And that I did pretty much with every single managerial change. Because I was like, if the coach see me in training, being the best player in every training in terms of the attitude, the commitment, the, you know, the consistency, he will put me in. Like, there's no way the manager will ignore a quality like that.
We can't stop talking about Chelsea without talking about the Champions League win. Talk us through the timeline from your perspective of getting close time and time again, and whether you ever had that fear that it wasn't going to happen.
You know, we were in five semifinals, then we lost the final, and then you always close, and then you almost feel like, this trophy is kind of, you know, avoiding us. It doesn't, for whatever reason, you know. But then in 2012, as I said, you know, I said to my wife in December, I said, you know what, this season's going horribly wrong. And but then everything in the Champions League is going, like, actually, you know, we manage. Every time, you know, we play the Champions League game, we sort of get there. We get the results. Like, we couldn't get in the league, but so I said to her, I said, this is gonna be ironic if in a season where we can't get anything going in the league, we actually finally managed to do it in the Champions League. But so I had that, you know, weird feeling that we will get somewhere, but you never really think in the moment you have a bad season and things are not really going well that you would win it. You know, in the back of your mind, you go, you know, you get closer, you survive another game, okay, then you survive the Napoli comeback, and you just go, then Barcelona, like, if you go down to 10 men at Barcelona and you go to nil down, and you ask anybody on putting the money on Chelsea going through, you just go, everybody will tell you that you are completely insane. So we against all the odds, we end up in the final, and you end up, you know, the irony is that you end up in the final playing a team who was the best in Europe at the time, together with Barcelona, and playing the home game in a Champions League final in front of their home fans, using their own dressing room, and having pretty much 80% of the fans on their side, because obviously all the, you know, you have a big, small portion kind of like for each set of fans, but it's German, in Germany, so most of the sponsors who get the tickets obviously gave it to people who had some connection to the game, you know, in Germany. So it was pretty much all of them Bayern fans. So, you know, we know when you walk out and you see everything red and just this blue part behind the goal, you just go, ah, this is a proper away game. So if you look at the script and you think like they have it all like that in front of their eyes, you know, like literally just to take it. But then again, we went and we said, you know, against all the odds, we ended up in the final, and then we can actually do it. And we had so many problems going to the final with injuries, and we actually had three lineups. People don't know, but literally ahead of the warm up of the game in Munich, we had three different lineups. And it was like, if this guy goes and survives the warm up, this is the lineup. If this one survived the warm-up, this is the lineup. Wow. If neither of them can, this is the lineup. So we had about five people warming up, not knowing whether they're actually playing or not. And then in the end, they all played. I think David Luiz with Gary Cahill, they were the two who didn't even know if they're going to go through the warm-up. And that's why we had so many variations. Even going to the warm-up, we still knew that one of these three lineups can actually happen.
And any time in the game, they could break down if they're that close.
Any moment, they could get injured any moment. You know, I think then, like, literally they couldn't walk after the game. But then you go with the adrenaline and with the importance of the game, you just go through it. So fair play to them. They managed to even to last 120 minutes. So
amazing.
You know,
story.
It was this shows again the you know, the mindset, the resilience. If you don't have it, you can just say, oh, I'm not 100%, but then you need to choose. But I think you need to choose wisely as well. Like, there's a fine line between, you know, being brave and stupid. I always say that, you know, you have to be brave to push your limits, but you can't be stupid. So if you know you're injured, you know you can't do, you can't perform, you will harm the team, not only yourself, but even the teams. And then you have to make the conscious decision to say, I can't perform. I play a year and a half with broken shoulders. Both, actually. Before I had the surgery, I had it for 14 months, like broken labrum, couldn't lift my arms. Nobody knew. I was training, I was playing, I was doing everything. And every single time I dived and made a save, I had tears coming like that. It was a terrible pain. But I knew I can perform. It was the two back-to-back titles, actually. So then you just go the second year, entire year. And you just go, you know, you just go, okay, it was probably not the wisest thing to do, but at the same time, I could perform. I had terrible pain every single day, but I could perform. So that was the thing. If I couldn't, and then I reached the point where I couldn't lift my arms anymore, I said, listen, I played the World Cup with it, and then I did the surgery. So then, but then you need to make the decision whether you say, well, it actually stops me from performing.
Yep.
Or you go, and halfway through, I was thinking, what should I do? Like, should I just carry on? And should I? And then, you know, as I said, it was a World Cup year. We were back to back title. I was still playing well. I think got the Golden Glove in the end of the season as well. So you just go, yeah, I can perform. But the pain was a disaster.
Chelsea by Courtois, and decide to sell you. You're at your peak still. I mean, you went and you were still goalkeeper of the year when you joined Arsenal. So actually, when it's a really big thing like that, do you allow yourself this feeling of a sense of injustice?
You know, you need to look at the reality as well, yeah? So when the first, like, we started training and you go through the preseason, you go through the games, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, they have no reason not to put me in a goal. Yeah, so if it goes really with that, there is no real reason in terms of the performance, the preparation, the preseason, everything. But the reason was one thing. You know, you have a guy with huge potential who comes back to the club. Everybody else wants him. And he has a year and a half on his contract. And you go like, if you don't let him play, he's not going to sign. So, you know, I was sitting there and I'm thinking, of course, they will go and say, okay, you go, you know, and give him a chance, because that's the only way how to sign and show him that, you know, he has a future. And to be honest to him, you know, the team started winning. He played well. I played 7 games in that season. I had 6 clean sheets, pretty much won everything apart of one game against Bradford. I think it was a disaster. We lost 4-2 at home in the FA Cup. I don't know how, but we did. But the rest of it, like, I played, you know, in a, like, really on the top of the game. So I was training every time I get a chance.
That almost makes it worse, though, in some ways.
No, but then you show the manager, you said, listen, you know, I'm there. I'm always ready. Whatever happens, you know, you just show, like, it was a pride for me as well to show, like, you know, I'm not going to throw the toys out and just show you that I'm upset. And then we won a title and Thibaut was really good. And then you just go, so now they have no reason to change him. Why would they, you know, why would they do it? He's 10 years younger than me. So you look at that and I'm thinking, okay, that's me done, actually, because I'm not going to play 10 games another season when I'm on the, you know, on top of my form. Why would I do it? And the same time, I wanted to stay in the Premier League. I wanted to stay in the Premier League. So I had plenty of offers to go abroad. But if you want to be the best, you want to compete with the best, you stay in the best league. So I said, this is where I actually went to speak to the owner. And I said to him, you know, I have 3 offers. One of them is like potentially Arsenal. And although it's a rival, I want to go there. And he didn't look too happy about that. But because of all I've done in 11 seasons for the club, then he said, okay, I will let people know that you make your choice and you make your choice.
So you chose where to go.
So I in the end, I said, well, I'm going, and this is my preferred, you know, destination. Yeah. I want to do it. And then, you know, Jose was not happy about that. And I know that if it was in a different circumstances, probably it would have never happened. I don't think they would allow me. Well, if I didn't speak to the big boss and literally he didn't, out of respect, he didn't let me go, I don't think it would have happened.
The question I've been looking forward to asking you most is about one of the most central figures of modern day football, Arsene Wenger. And I'm intrigued as having somebody that went to him after you made that decision to move on from Chelsea. What was your experiences of him?
You know, with Arsene, you know, it's like you see managers with different approaches, but Arsene was one of the people who actually, you know, believe in people's talent. Like they, you know, when you come to Arsenal based on some scouting, based on what you can do and how you can do it, he likes you to use that, you know, to express yourself and use that. It was a different approach in a way, you know, because it was like when most of the managers, they would say, okay, use your talent, but this is a structure. You have to do this and you defend here and you do that. But he almost said, like, you, of course you had the structure. You wouldn't do that. But he really makes sure that the player is in position and in the place where they can express all the talent and quality they have. And that's why the football reflects it as well, because you have this nice, fluid, you know, the Arsenal way. It comes pretty much from that people, you know, use the football qualities to, you know, control play technical way, the And it was actually, you know, a different approach what I had experienced, like to a certain extent, and I enjoyed it. I think with all his experience, as well as knowing the club upside down, you could see he make huge impact in there. And at the same time, you know, they went through some difficulties when Emirates was built. Obviously, they had to pay the Emirates Stadium off, and then he had to deal every year with selling the best players to pay the stadium off, but yet still being top four and performing and playing good football. So, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to go there, it was the challenge to bring him back the title.
Mm.
That was something I looked at and I was thinking, you know what, that's actually my aim, you know, get it there. They were in the Champions League final, lost it. You know, if he can get that, that was my motivation. Like going there to say, okay, these are two trophies they don't have. It would be actually brilliant if we can do it. And it was in the moment where the club, you know, started being in a strong position of being able to bring players because of the stadium was paid. And you feel like, okay, that's, you know, that could be actually a really nice challenge. And I really enjoyed it, I have to say.
And did you feel for him the way it ended? I mean, I still look back on the criticism that manager got and think, how did certain sections of supporters not see quite what he'd done for them?
I think, you know, when you have a huge passion and you want the club to do well and it always close and you don't jump the last hurdle, you almost feel like, you know, the players were changing, but the manager was not. So maybe the last hurdle will be the manager change.
Mm.
So I think that some people felt about it like that. And you know, it's really unique if you have someone over 20 years in the same club. You know, to be able to do that, you need to be really, you know, you need to have a special circumstances in a way as well. And maybe that, you know, longevity after a while came to some people to say, oh, I always see the same manager, same style, same this, same that. So maybe it just came to the point where people felt like, you know, some change is needed, but then, you know, but it's the way you express it as well can be, it's the way it's done. So some people took it really in their hands like that, but you know, in a way, I think retrospectively everybody realized how much impact and how big importance Arsene Wenger plays in the history of the club. You know, from the Invincibles, the titles before, all the way, you know, the Champions League campaign to the final, where they were a bit unlucky, and then you just go, you know, like build the stadium, the training ground. So, you know, he left a huge legacy there.
Let's talk about your departure from Arsenal and how quickly you went straight back to Chelsea. But I was amazed that one minute you were a player, the next minute you were in the sort of the boardroom senior management team at a football club. Why was it so quick from finishing playing to wanting to go back to Chelsea?
You know, that it was actually the circumstances, yeah. So when Michael Emenalo left Chelsea, there was this job which was there at the time, and I played the last game in Baku, came home, and I was thinking, okay, I take a week where I don't want to hear about anything anywhere, and then let's see what comes, yeah. But then I had the call before, or like a month, even before I decided that I'm not going to play anymore. So I was still playing. And the question was, how long you intend to play? Like, you know, we would like you back at some point, at some stage. But in terms of the planning, like, what is your? And I said, no, I'm a player, so that's it. Don't you know? I can't tell. But obviously, that then when I finished, that the week after I took the week off, I got the phone call from Chelsea, and they said, listen, so this job is there, But if you don't take it, we have people, you know, you compete with in terms for the position. So if you wanna try, you come, or somebody else, we need to think of somebody else. But then, and then I was sitting at home and I'm thinking, if somebody comes, does well, then this chapter is closed almost. And I'm thinking, am I in a position to let this pass, or I have to take it? And I'm, you know, you think, you go, it's a big step. It's a completely different job. It's a huge learning process and fast. You know, nobody gives you too much time to, you know, you just kind of jump in and swim. But with all the education I have, all the studies I've done, you know, the MBA, the coaching badges, the understanding of the football club, seeing it at Arsenal, seeing it at Chelsea, seeing it like as a player, you just go, you know what, I think I can give it a go. I could play another 2 years, but I was not fit. And if you feel like I knew that maybe I would not be able to train 100%, I would not be able to play 100% because of that. And I don't like that. You know, I either do everything 100% or I do not. I prefer nothing, or close to 100% or nothing. And I was not sure I can do that. And therefore I was like, you know what, I prefer to end it like that on my terms almost, and to get around my head around it, rather than getting injured halfway through the season and saying, oh, sorry guys, I need to retire because I'm injured, and I didn't want to do that.
Was it hard for you to go to a manager who, when you were a player, was the boss, right? You're suddenly having to go to a manager and say, what you're doing isn't right, like the way this is going isn't correct.
Well, luckily the managers I had was not anybody who would be coaching me, so he didn't feel weird, he didn't feel strange, you know. And I think the nice part, like for example having Frank as the manager, was actually a good part, because you have this I know him from a different perspective too, so you can, you know, you have that both sides of the coin. And we had always like a mutual respect to, you know, as players. And then obviously you work together, so you try to make sure that, you know, we get it right. Because I think he cared a lot about, you know, coming back to the club. He knew he got a big opportunity to come back very early in his, you know, coaching career. So obviously he really cared about making it work. And we obviously, we all really desperately wanted for him to work, you know.
Frank, when we interviewed him and we spoke about his time at Chelsea, said that in hindsight, he stopped communicating upwards. When things started to unravel, he started to become more focused on the team rather than communicating upwards. And from your perspective, seeing that, what did you do to feel you could intervene or help him or mentor him?
No, we always talked about it, because you know you need to always find the right balance. Yeah, and I think in my position you kind of you have to help the first team as much as you can, but at the same time you represent the club, so you need to make sure that whatever's done, it's not against what the club vision is, what the club tries to achieve. So you sort of go and think, okay, you know, what does the manager want? How visible he wants you to be? And so I always went along with that. I always said with them, I said, okay, how visible you want me to be? Right. Of course, I have to do my job. And my job is this, 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 and that. But if you prefer for me not to be too visible, that it feels like I'm kind of like, always supervising, then fine, you know, you tell me and I do that. So this, you need to always, you know, think of the balance between.
So what did Frank say to you then when you asked that?
I think, you know, Frank with this, he wanted to make sure that when he's with the team, that the team knows that, you know, he's the boss, he's there, he's the main guy to deal with the players so I would be, you know, when I was around, when we said, okay, I'm going to be around because I need to watch whatever. And if he said, well, today I prefer, you know, there is not too many people watching, I would like to have like the team just concentrating this and that, I wouldn't go.
What so about that's Thomas?
That's as I said, it's, you know, you need to have that, you know, way of making sure that you don't compromise your job, but at the same time you make people feel, okay, I prefer to read like that, and then they just do their job. Yeah.
And what about your relationship with Thomas Tuchel? Well, how was that the same and how was it different?
You know, Thomas, because he's German, he's used to having the sport director on the bench.
So he was used to it.
So he goes like, you know, you do anything you need to do. And I said to him, well, you know, I actually enjoyed, you know, being around, because I feel the vibe of the, you know, the training session. You feel the vibe of the players. You have that, you know, energy. And of course, you know, you're not there every day because you have other stuff to do too. But at the same time, you know, I like that. And I think he was one of, he said, you know, I always like to, you know, to know your opinion. And so we, you know, I was always around, which was it's slightly different way. But as I said, it's more like how you make it work the best for everybody. Yeah. I think that's the most important part. So you need to, as I said, the main part is, of course, you do your job. You do as best as you can, and then you find a way that other people feel comfortable and they can do their job as best as they can.
What would you say was the difference between winning the Champions League as a player and then winning it as part of the leadership team?
You know, it was more satisfying winning it actually in my second role. I don't know why, but I know why. Because you know, when you are in that team, you know that's the team, the people who are closely working with the team, the coaching staff, medical staff, the people you see every day. And you sort of never, you don't really think too much about all the people in the offices, the people who cut the videos, do the analysis, the people who scout, go around, you know, the secretary who deals with every suspensions, emails, tickets, I don't know, there's millions of people who works around, you know, that you have that success overall. So when you are in that other position, you sort of feel the happiness for all that. Because we sometimes, like as a football player, you underestimate how much pride, happiness, and joy the people who are behind the scenes and practically unknown to everybody, a part of the team, you know, how proud they are when you win it, how happy they are when you win it. So then you imagine all these people who work every day behind the scenes, almost invisibly, but so importantly, then you just go, you know, all these people are happy, including you. You know, I was not on that pitch, so I can't tell I won it. But I, you know, when you sort of help to build the team, to kind of put the process in place where everybody feels comfortable and the manager can do the job and everybody else can do the job, it's satisfying. I have to say the satisfaction for far greater in that moment, because I realize how many more people actually we made happy.
So when I look at your CV, it says you won one Champions League, right? It should say two, no?
It's fine. I
in
know,
your head?
I know. In my head, I know I was a part of helping it. And I take, but, you know, ultimately, I was not on the pitch. So yeah. I think it's rightly that I'm not, I don't have two, because I was not on the pitch.
So would you tell us about the process of choosing to leave Chelsea then?
Well, you know, there was, we all know there was a lot of changes. You know, we had, you know, with the difficulty of the sanctions, the difficulty of changing in the circumstances. It was never, you know, if you go through a transition or change of ownership, which is planned and prepared, then of course you plan and prepare for it. You know the timeline. You know exactly in which circumstances and what will be happening, and you can, you know, you plan with it. You know, you have discussions about, you know, the future plans, your discussion, how, what, you know, you have that. If it happens in the circumstances it happen, nothing really prepares you for that. And then things are happening sometimes very quickly, and you end up in the situations where, you know, you discover how, you know, how things might work, how it's going to be, what's the new vision, what's the new plan, what anything. And, you know, as I said, the way I am, the way I do things is that I have to believe that I'm 100% into the case of, like, this is what I do, and I'm 100% in it. This is where we go. And I have certain ways of doing things, and I believe in them. So when you have a lot of changes, and then suddenly you have that feeling like, okay, that might be too many changes to fit in, or to simply take part of it, like, with 100% commitment. I thought, like, you know what, maybe when everything changed, maybe it will be actually beneficial for everybody if people choose their own people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you come as a new owner, you can choose the people you want to work with, and you have, and you probably have the people who feel like 100% in it. And I felt that, you know, I felt that at the moment it was like, probably the best for everybody would be if I'm not there. The new owners, they wanted me to stay.
Right.
But it was my decision. It was my decision to go. And I said, well, this is what I want to do. And I think, I believe it's the right decision for me and for everybody. And as I felt that time like that, and that's why I did it.
You still feel it's the right decision?
You know, I miss my work, actually. I have to say, you know, I really enjoyed it. But at the same time, I don't regret it. You know, that's the part. Yeah. I think I made a decision. And I do other things now, which make me grow as well as a person for the future. I have time to finish my coaching badges. I have time to finish my PhD thesis. I have time to, you know, to spend more time with my kids.
At the moment, you're lost to football, and you've got so much experience, so much knowledge. You've gleaned and learned so much. Do you want to get back in?
You know, I would say that if the right opportunity and at the right time comes, yes. And because, as I said, I really enjoyed it, and of course, you know, football will always remain a big part of my life, of my passion, and as well, you know, I would like to share the knowledge I gained during my career as a player, and then, you know, in those 3 years in the opposite side of playing field. But you know, as I said, it need to be, it needs to be always, as I said, in a circumstances where you feel like, okay, this is a right project, this is a nice project, this is really worth investing all my time and energy and in which position and how. You know, I enjoy coaching, for example. That's something I really love. I can actually see myself coaching.
Wow.
Because it's one thing which I really, you know, when I look at games, I always look at the strategies, the space, the, you know, the plays, the how other, you know, managers do different things, and I always try to think, you know, what would I do in that situation? How would I do it? Would it work? Would it not work? You know, stuff like that. So that I have to say, it's something I sort of enjoy.
That will be the headline people now take from this whole conversation. Petr Cech wants to be a manager. Look, Petr, it's been a really, really interesting conversation. We finish with some quick fire questions. The first one is, which three non-negotiable behaviors do you and the people around you need to buy into?
I think first would be definitely the effort, because, like, if you don't put the effort in anything, then you don't even start. Yeah? Yep. So it might go together with this commitment, like, you either committed or not. So if you commit, then, you know, and the attitude, how you do it. Because if you have the commitment and if you have the attitude, then you have the discipline as well. So it comes all together. But I would say the effort always comes first. Yep. Like, if you can't put the 100% effort and the commitment into the case, I don't think you get too far.
So the three were effort, commitment,
and attitude.
Attitude.
What advice would you give to a teenage Petter just starting out?
I would, I think the advice I would give applies to anything. It's to make sure that you don't waste a day of your life, because the life is too short to waste it. And if you want to achieve something, you need to use every time to, you know, to do meaningful things to improve yourself or your position in whatever you want to achieve.
If you could go back to one moment in your life, what would it be and why?
You know, as many things as happened to me during the life, good things, bad things, I always say I wouldn't change a thing, because I you know what, I would go back into that moment when we won the Champions League. You know, that feeling, the great feeling of achievement, satisfaction, chasing the trophy for so long and being so close and yet so far many times, and that's the ultimate best feeling you yeah. have. So that's probably that's probably one, because that joy was special. But as I mean, you know, there are many things you do and you look back and you think, if I could change that, but it might change the way you are after, and you might not have achieved, you know, the other stuff. So as I said, you know, as with good things, bad things, I wouldn't change anything.
What's your greatest strength? What's your biggest weakness?
The greatest strength, I would say, my consistency, the discipline and consistency. That's what drives me every day, because there are many things I don't like to do, but I know I have to do them. I do them. So I would say this is the mental strength in terms of being consistent with my emotions as well.
The final question, Petter, what's your one golden rule to live a high performance life?
The consistency, yeah. Again, I think it's the inner engine. Because if you have the inner engine, you have the consistency and you have the discipline, and then it allows you to improve every day.
Damien.
Jake.
A conversation with a footballer, but not about football. I mean, I love that idea of being a kid in goal, panicking in case it goes 1-0. It does go 1-0, and then it releases him. And this idea of playing with freedom that he managed to get from having the score in his head at 0-0, regardless of what was going on, I think was fascinating, because again, it's a reminder that we see these bulletproof people, these world-class performers, these elite athletes. This is Petr Cech in goal, one of the best teams in the world. He must be fine. Yet even he's had to put in place certain techniques and tricks to fool himself so he can perform at his best. And if he needs to do it, we all need to be doing it.
Yeah, the stuff around process is something that any of us, whether we like football or not, whether we admire Petr Cech, whether we're Chelsea fans, almost doesn't matter. The process stuff is applicable to every single one of us listening.
And it was a reminder, you know, when Petr spoke about that head injury, it's a reminder that the process is also there for you when times are tough. You know, it was following that process that meant they questioned whether this was the end of his career. Then it was, how many months will he be out? How many seasons will he not play again for? And, you know, within just a few weeks, he was back training and playing. And I thought it was fascinating. And then to sort of have the bravery to go upstairs at Chelsea to become a senior member of the team in the boardroom. I loved when he spoke about winning the Champions League was better, not as a player. And it reminds us that, you know, we put these players on a pedestal, but there's hundreds of amazing people behind them who aren't earning the money, getting the accolades, driving the cars, but it matters just as much to them.
Yeah, so it goes to the very heart of these clubs are part of they represent a community, they represent people. And I think when we can tap into that sense of purpose, we've heard it so often of getting that sense of alignment. Paul Barber spoke about it at Brighton. Tracy Neville spoke about it representing women in England and removing the glass ceiling when she was the head coach of the England netball team. That sense of purpose and recognising the community you represent and how you go about winning is an incredibly powerful life force. And Petr is got that interesting perspective of having been on the playing end of it and then on the leadership end of that. And he recognises that it's far more fulfilling to represent the people that you that are part of your tribe.
And just to tell the story to people listening to this, you know, when we stopped recording, he just sort of volunteered why he came on the podcast, didn't he? It's the first time he's spoken since he left Chelsea. He's not discussed any of that stuff before. And he said, it's because we're in this world where it's all short term. It's all quick sound bites. It's all immediate reaction. It's all opinion. He said, this is a platform for long term conversation, for deep discussion, for empathy being put ahead of opinion. And I think for Petter to understand the value of these conversations fills me with real joy.
Yeah. You know, and again, for people that are listening to it, this is an edited version of a 3-hour conversation. Petter was the epitome of no shortcuts, whether that was his success in his playing career, his success in his subsequent role in football administration, or whether it was making sure this podcast was as interesting as possible. No shortcuts seems to be his whole mantra.
Love that.
I absolutely loved the conversation with Petter. And if you want to watch it as well as just listen to it, you can do so right now. Head to High Performance on YouTube and join the millions of people who watch our conversations there rather than just listen to them. As always, huge thanks to you for growing and sharing this podcast among your community. Please continue to spread the learnings you're taking from these conversations. Remember, there is no secret. It is all there for you. So chase world-class basics. Don't get high on your own supply. Remain humble, curious, and empathetic, and I'll see you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.